The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So welcome, everyone. It's really nice to be here with all of you. And before I begin, I'm going to tell you I've had a terrible cough for about a month. And this is the first time I'm using my voice for any length of time. So I hope that things go well. If they don't, you'll understand why. So Andrea is off in Burma, the regular teacher. She's sitting a meditation in Yangon, and then she's going to be managing a meditation retreat. She's sitting for a month herself, and then she's managing a retreat in the Sagan Hills, an annual retreat that happens there in Burma every year that's led by Carol Wilson and Michelle McDonald Smith from the Insight Meditation Society. Anyway, she's off doing her meditation bit in Burma, and she asked me if I would come and speak to all of you tonight. So I'm really happy to be here. And I've been giving a little bit of thought to what I might want to talk to you about. And I think I would like to talk to you about meditation, appropriately enough. And more importantly, I'd like to talk about how we go about developing a healthy relationship to the meditative process itself, as well as to the object of the meditation, whatever that happens to be, whatever object we choose. As Maureen mentioned, I trained in Burma, and you would think that I would have had every possible advantage of learning shortcuts to this whole process, but unfortunately, I may have had the advantages, I just wasn't bright enough to pick up on them. And so I had to suffer through a lot of my early experiences with meditation. And my early months, and especially the first year that I was in Burma, was really quite challenging. And a lot of it had to do with, you know, physical conditions, just plain, simple physical conditions. The climate was really tropical and hot and steamy, and the food was not familiar, and there were lots of creepy crawlies that I wasn't used to, and all sorts of things like that. But basically, the meditation itself was hampered by the fact that I brought my own ideas about meditation with me and my own expectations about what it meant to be a good meditator, what it meant to meditate in the particular tradition that I had entered into, what was expected of me, what I expected of myself, and all of it was completely fabricated in my mind, had nothing to do with reality. But I suffered because of it. And I realized in reflecting on it later that I had really developed a kind of aversive relationship to my meditation objects as well as to the actual meditation process itself, so that there were times where I just look at the cushion and think, I can't do it. Not another time. I just can't go there. And I realized that this aversiveness that I experienced wasn't in any way unique to me, that lots of people have the same kinds of things come up in their meditation, whether they're meditating in Burma or in Palo Alto. The fact is that what we meet when we meditate is the habits of our mind. We run into our stuff and it doesn't easily go away, and it's not something that the meditation itself, the meditation process itself, is meant to, intended to, or able to overcome. So any attempts that overcoming what comes up or suppressing what comes up is completely our own doing and will lead to a result that's not what we are necessarily going for. So there's this looking at the meditative process, and then there's looking at the object of the meditation. And so maybe we'll do both of these as I go along here. Because the object of meditation that I want to focus on tonight is the breath, or the practice of mindfulness of breathing, Anapanasati. This is a practice that many people don't realize the profundity of this practice, because it seems so obvious and so simple. But it's the practice that the Buddha himself used in order to become enlightened. And it's the practice that is the first foundation of the four foundations of mindfulness. And it's the practice that, if cultivated, the entire four foundations of mindfulness will be realized. And in fact, one can take this practice all the way to ultimate freedom. So I want to say that there are different ways of approaching mindfulness of breathing, and different ways to cultivate the practice. So two distinctly different ways, and both of them are completely valid, and both of them are completely skillful and useful to take up. And it really depends on our temperament or where we are in our practice and who we're working with, because you actually need a teacher for one of them a little bit more than maybe for the other. But you can cultivate mindfulness of breathing in order to brighten mindfulness. You can cultivate this attention to breathing in order to develop a momentary concentration, the ability to stay focused on your breath in a momentary fashion. And what will happen is that mindfulness itself, sati in Pali, will brighten. So this is one way. Another method, or another practice, is called samatha, and it's a practice where the meditator learns to focus on a single meditation object, in this case the breath, to the exclusion of everything else, in order to deepen, in order to develop and deepen concentration. And when practices Anapanasati in this way, the instructions for Anapanasati are a little bit different, and I'll give you an example of both of them in a moment. But when one practices in this way, what one is doing is, instead of cultivating a momentary concentration, one is cultivating a sustained concentration. And this sustained concentration will take the meditator into a place of deeper concentration, and mindfulness then will brighten in that way. So as I said, these are two distinct paths. One is to cultivate mindfulness that would lead into Vipassana meditation, and one is to cultivate concentration or samadhi that may lead into a deep state of concentration, which is known as jhana, or a mental absorption that happens. Whether you're cultivating mindfulness of breathing to develop vipassana meditation, or whether you're cultivating it to develop samatha meditation, there's a few things that you can do in order to avoid falling into the trap of having an aversive relationship with the object, with the breath. And you can do are all of you familiar with the Brahma Viharas, the four practices of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic or altruistic joy, and equanimity? These are practices that the Buddha this is another form of meditation, another meditation practice that the Buddha gave to his monks. And but without talking about those meditation practices, I want to just talk about those qualities. Because if you bring the quality of friendliness to the object of your meditation, in this case, the breath, you will find that you have more space around the way that you meet the breath, the way the breath actually appears or disappears, depending on how your meditation may be unfolding. So you can actively bring this quality of friendliness, metta. It's a quality that you can apply to the actual process, to the meditative process when you're using mindfulness of breathing. You can also apply compassion, or karuna is the sati word for it. Compassion, when the mind just simply refuses to cooperate, where it won't stay on the breath object for more than a couple of breaths. It just, you put the mind there, and a breath and a half later, you're off to your weekend, or you're thinking about something that happened this morning, or it just isn't happening, and you just keep trying over and over again, and it just doesn't work. And so this is a time when you can actually begin to realize that this is a human condition. It's not unique to you or to me. It's just what we experience as human beings with these minds. And sometimes it's just difficult. And it's when you realize the difficulty, and when you realize that, oh, this is really happening to me, this is really difficult, sometimes the heart opens with this upwelling of compassion. And you could get a taste of what real compassion feels like then, when you can turn that compassion towards your own experience and apply it in this way. And this is a very skillful means for dealing with your meditation object. I'm really trying to focus all this back onto the object of your meditation, because this is something that we don't, or something that I didn't realize I could do, especially in those early months and years of taking up meditation. You can also apply the feeling of joy, of altruistic joy or sympathetic joy, for when it's really going well. You can really feel happy and joyful that this is really going well. This actually sustains the meditation. It supports the meditation. You know, I sat this last year for 3 months with the monks up at Abhayagiri, and one of the instructions that the abbot would give over and over again was, look for things that are going well for you. Look for things that are good within you. But in this particular, for the purposes of this particular conversation, are going well in your meditation, look for those things and allow those things to support you. Recognize them, acknowledge them, and allow them to support you. So in this way, you can actually feel this sense of altruistic joy welling up. And this is good. You don't have to suppress it. You don't have to turn away from it. And then the last quality, the quality of equanimity, which is known as upekkha in Pali, is to meet the entire experience with a sense of equalness, evenness, of accepting it exactly as it is. And there's a kind of freedom and peace that's really instantaneously recognizable when you begin to meet your experience with equanimity, whatever it happens to be. Someone asked me a question earlier this evening. What happens when you have a terrible emotional trauma come up and you can't keep your mind on the breath, you see? So my answer was that at that point, that becomes the object of your meditation, but not for the purposes of investigation and engagement, but for the purposes of simply recognizing that this is what has arisen and this is what's got your attention at the moment. So it's just, and in this way, this kind of recognition is sort of the flavor and the first touch of equanimity, when you can just accept what's there without pushing anything away. So this idea that mindfulness of breathing has to occur in a certain way and that we reach out and cling on to it. The word in Pali is upadana, this clinging. It's clinging to an idea. It's clinging to a concept. This is a surefire formula to end up with us feeling a lot of suffering, a lot of dukkha around this. The breath itself is really neutral. It's just the breath. And our relationship with the breath is something that we cultivate and create on our own. And sometimes it's a good relationship, and sometimes it's an adversarial relationship. But if it's an adversarial relationship, we're really in trouble because the meditation won't go anywhere. And what's going to happen is that we're going to suffer until we just put it down and start over again. So with mindfulness of breathing, it's best to realize that the breath is neutral and we can make it our friend. We can be friendly towards it, but it's not going to do anything except be the breath. So we can have a nice relationship with it, or a friendly relationship with it, or we can ignore it, or we can, you know, try to jump on it and grab it. All of these things are possibilities. And in the course of your meditation practice, you'll probably experience all of those things sooner or later. The breath will come and go on its own without us having to do anything. And when our mind, when we decide that we're going to use the breath as the object of our meditation, And when we bring our focus of attention onto the breath, and three breaths later, we're off thinking, you know, a very all too familiar response is to get really disappointed in ourselves, or to think that we've somehow failed, or to get angry, or to get impatient, or to think that the breath is a useless object, or to go through this whole gamut of thoughts and emotions. There's really only one thing that you can do, and it's the antidote to all of those things, and that is simply to notice that the breath, that the mind has left the object. And then you simply bring the mind back to the object. You simply bring the mind back to the breath. And you do that over and over and over and over again. And finally, slowly, gradually, over time, the mind will be, you will discipline the mind and train the mind to come back to this primary object, in this case the breath, and the coming back will become more and more effortless. And you sort of have to take that on trust if you haven't experienced it. But what happens is that the meditation itself takes over. And the effort that you have to put into sort of directing the meditation becomes less and less. Less and less. And you really have to put the effort down and just let the mind return to the object. It's a little bit like if you were running down a hill. You know, you begin the run and you have to make the effort to start running. But pretty soon, gravity and momentum will take over. And if you keep running, you'll end up flat on your nose. So you sort of have to back off and just let yourself be carried along. In other words, you have to kind of receive the meditation. You have to stop doing and just receive. But in the beginning, there is this doing that's necessary. And if you're going to cultivate Vipassana or Samatha meditation, there are other kinds of meditations as well, and they're completely legitimate ways to meditate. But I'm not talking about those tonight. I'm talking about these two ways. If you're going to cultivate this type of meditation, you are going to have to get involved in your meditation, and you're going to have to do in the beginning. So you're going to have to bring the mind back to the object repeatedly, 100 times, 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times, who knows how many times. And sooner or later, as soon as possible, it's really wise and skillful to put down any kind of ideas or judgments about why you have to bring the mind back. The fact is, the mind has drifted. Mindfulness woke you up. You know the mind has drifted, and it's not on the object any longer. And so, there's only one skillful thing to do, and that's to gently return the mind to the primary object of the meditation. And in this way, you begin to discipline and train the mind. When the mind slips and goes into thoughts, you know, sooner or later you may begin to recognize there's patterns here, there's habits here, there's something going on. But during the meditation, I really encourage you not to try to understand why the mind has gone here, or not to try to investigate the reasons for what's really going on. This is not the time to do that. There's another time when you can apply that kind of investigative process, but it's not on the meditation cushion. All that has to happen is that you recognize drifted thinking, object, drifted thinking, object. And that's it. It's as simple as that, and as difficult as that, too, I might hasten to add. What I want to try to emphasize here is that many people hear that instruction and they try to force the mind back onto the breath. And this is natural in the beginning, but it also is not useful. It doesn't help. In fact, it's a real obstacle to meditation actually developing. Rather than forcing the mind back to the object or being seduced by your thinking and moving into it, what you might want to try to experiment with is cultivating an attitude of actual disinterest in what the mind is moving to, no matter what it is. It could be a sound, it could be a feeling in your body, it could be anything that takes you away from your object. Rather than denying it or suppressing it or contracting around it, if you simply cultivate an attitude of not now, later, I'll take this up later, but not right now. An example that comes to mind for me that works for me is that, you know, you're sitting in your house, you're in your favorite chair, and you're in the middle of a really good book, a really good read, and somebody starts knocking at your door. A salesman wants to sell you something. He's knocking at your door. Well, it's not that you don't know the salesman is out there knocking at your door. It's just that this book is where you want to be. And so you say, not today, I'm not interested. And you go back to your book. And hopefully he goes away sooner or later. And in the same way, whatever has pulled our mind, it's almost like a door-to-door salesman that's knocking. And so it's not like we go out there and like shoot him in the knee or something. Go away, don't bother me. Or we pretend that he's not there. It's just that not interested, not right now. And a little trick that I learned that I find really useful in my own meditation is that I will sometimes give myself, I'll just tell myself, not now. This thought, I know it's juicy, I know it's interesting, but just not now. Now I'm going to meditate. I'm going to at least try to meditate. And sometimes that works, because what I also tell myself is that I'll take up this thought later. If this thought is worthy of my attention, when the meditation is over, I can come back to it, or I can bring it up again tomorrow, or I can do something like that. And so this is a skillful means in which to deal with some of these things. So I want to just recap a little bit here on what I've talked about so far. And then I want to spend a little bit of time talking about how the Buddha himself taught Anapanasati, or mindfulness of breathing, to his monks. and the instructions that he gave to them for cultivating this really beautiful and profound practice. But recapping so far, I want to emphasize that there are different ways to be in relationship to the meditative process and to the object of the meditation. We can have a friendly, wholesome, healthy relationship, or we can have an aversive, adversarial, confrontational, impossible relationship. One of them will lead to a meditative experience and a meditation practice that will grow and develop, will flower and fruit over time, and one of them will lead nowhere, just to suffering. There are a couple of different ways to develop mindfulness of breathing. One of them is to develop it for the purposes of momentary concentration and the practice of vipassana. The other is to develop it for the purposes of one-pointed focus, one-pointed concentration that will lead into a state of deeper and deeper states of concentration and may actually take the meditator into a mental absorption. I encourage all of you to apply to the practice itself and to the actual breath object, the four divine, they're called the Brahma Vihara. Vihara is the divine abodes, the practice of friendliness or loving kindness towards the meditation object, the practice of compassion or karuna when the going gets rough, mudita or altruistic joy when things are going really well and you can sort of really appreciate that things are going well, and the sense of equanimity with however the object comes up and however you meet the object. Please don't cling to your ideas or expectations about mindfulness of breathing or about meditation in particular. These are all mental fabrications. They'll all lead to disappointment, and so don't cling on to them. It causes suffering. So I want to just briefly go through what the Buddha spent a long, long time talking about, and then I want to give you some time for some questions, if you have any questions. But, excuse me, I want to just read you this one paragraph out of the Majjhima Nikaya, and this is Sutta number 118 on mindfulness of breathing, the Anapanasati Sutta. And the Buddha says here, bhikkhus, he's addressing his assembly of monks, when mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is of great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness. When the four foundations of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they fulfill the seven factors, the seven enlightenment factors. When the seven enlightenment factors are developed and cultivated, they fulfill true knowledge and deliverance. So, through the practice of Anapanasati, you can go all the way to Nibbana, believe it or not. So, I wish all of you a happy and rapid journey to Nibbana. So, I want to now go through the ways that he lays out in this sutta for his bhikkhus to train. So he said, and how, bhikkhus, is mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated so that it is of great fruit and great benefit? So he lists a number of different ways, and I have found about 14 of them. And so I'm going to go through them, and I'm going to talk just briefly about some of them. So he says, first, the way that you develop mindfulness of breathing is a bhikkhu trains thus. I breathe in long, and I breathe out. I breathe in long, and I breathe out long. I breathe in short, and I breathe out short. And I know that I'm breathing in long, and I know that I'm breathing out short. So first we notice that we're breathing. Then we notice whether we're breathing, what the duration of our breath is, the time it takes to breathe. So a long breath is a longer duration. A short breath is a shorter duration. And so one of the things that we can do when we're practicing Anapanasati is simply notice whether we're breathing long or breathing short. It's also a way that keeps us coming back to the object and focused on the object. A bhikkhu breathes in, experiencing the whole body of the breath. A bhikkhu breathes out, experiencing the whole body of the breath. So there's not agreement on what this actually means, but I'll tell you the two most common things. There's a school in the Buddhist world that believes that the whole body of breath is referring to feeling the breath in the entire body. And there's another school that believes that what the Buddha means here is that the whole body of breath means the beginning of the breath, the pause in between, and the end of the breath. So a whole inhale and exhalation is the body of the breath. And so knowing the whole body of the breath, so I was trained in that school. And so one of the things that I do is I notice when the breath begins and I follow it, and I notice when the breath ends. And this helps to keep me with the breath. So this is another way. He then goes on to say, I breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily formations. I breathe out, tranquilizing the body formations. And so what happens, and what the Buddha is referring to, is that as we begin to follow the breath in a more conscious and continuous way, where we can actually sort of give rise to the feeling of tranquility and calmness in our body. We begin to feel peaceful. It just feels good to be with the breath. If you just think about just following the breath and you're relaxing, and suddenly you're just feeling very relaxed in your body. So you can actually give rise to this feeling of tranquility. He goes on to say, a bhikkhu trains thus. I breathe in, experiencing rapture. I breathe out, experiencing rapture. So here what the Buddha is referring to is a samatha yogi who has, in particular, a samatha yogi, one who's developed this ability to concentrate deeply, because what happens is that one of the factors of concentration that arises is a feeling of rapture. Sometimes it's a feeling of rapture, and it's one of the signs that concentration is moving towards absorption. So the meditation, which doesn't mean that you have to be a samatha yogi to feel a rapture. You can feel it practicing vipassana. It just arises in a different way. But in this case, the Buddha is referring to actually going into a state of mental absorption. So he's talking about the first two There are four jhana states, or four mental absorption states, material jhanas, and the first two jhanas, the meditator experiences this feeling of rapture that may just overcome the body, wash over the body. He goes on to say, "I breathe in and I breathe out, experiencing pleasure." And this is the word for pleasure, or the Pali word for pleasure is sukha. And again, the Buddha is referring to these deep states of mental absorption, where, and he's now talking about the first three jhanas, because in the third jhana, the feeling of rapture falls away because it's a little bit gross as one begins to move through these states. So one can take pleasure as the pleasure associated with mindfulness of breathing as the object of the meditation. He goes on to say, "I breathe in and I breathe out, experiencing mental formations." In this case, perceptions and feelings is what he means by mental formations. "I breathe in and I breathe out, experiencing the mind." And what he's talking about in the mind here is he's actually talking about the four jhanas, the four mental absorptions, the four jhanas. So he's talking about breathing in and breathing out and experiencing the state of jhana. He goes on to say, "I breathe in and I breathe out, gladdening the mind." All of these higher things are referring to these absorption states. In this case, it's a reference to the first and second jhanas, in which rapture is present. He goes on to say, concentrating the mind. "I breathe in and I breathe out, concentrating the mind." "I breathe in and I breathe out, liberating the mind." In this case, he's talking about liberating the mind from the hindrances that keep us from settling into our meditations. And then he moves into the realm of vipassana. And he says, "I shall breathe in and breathe out, contemplating impermanence. I shall breathe in and breathe out, contemplating fading away. I shall breathe in and breathe out, contemplating cessation. And I shall breathe in and breathe out, contemplating relinquishment." So when we practice vipassana, what we're actually doing is we're taking whatever phenomena is arising in our meditation, and we're recognizing the impermanent suffering and non-self nature of all phenomena, whether it's mental or physical. And so what the Buddha is doing here is he's actually applying mindfulness of breathing to this process of vipassana. So those are the 14 things that I was able to pick out that the Buddha teaches or taught his bhikkhus in order to cultivate mindfulness of breathing. What I offered you in the beginning is so much more simple. If you just are willing to trust me that by cultivating friendliness, You can do all of these things, and that it doesn't, you don't have to make a big deal out of it. You can read this, and it's beautiful, and it's profound, and every word of it is filled with truth. But it can also be a little bit daunting to even experienced meditators. And if you realize that mindfulness of breathing is a profound practice that you can take up, and you can take up exactly where you are, and it can bear such beautiful flowers and fruit for you if you put down your ideas about how it should unfold or what meditation is all about. So with that, we have a few minutes here, about 10 minutes. If anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to do my best to try to answer them. Yes?
Is it significant that the way you laid it out was the cultivating of concentration and then delving into Vipassana?
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure the question. Is it significant to develop the concentration first and then move to Vipassana?
Was it the way you laid it out significant in that it flowed first from concentration to Vipassana?
I think that that's just because that's the way that I was trained. It's not that that's the right way or that there's other ways aren't right or something like that. So that's a very good question. You can cultivate a Vipassana practice without developing a Samatha practice first. The way that this was, the way that it's classically taught and historically taught in Asia is that one develops concentration in the service of insight. So you can go into all eight jhanas and experiencing these sublime, unspeakably beautiful states, and they won't liberate you. You have to practice Vipassana in order for insight to arise, the kind of insight that can literally uproot ignorance and cut it off. That will not happen with a samadhi practice. But what samadhi practice does, what concentration practice does, is it brings the mind into a state of unification that's profoundly peaceful and also extremely powerful, so that what has been called the light of wisdom actually grows bright in the mind of the meditator. And you can take this mind that's been trained in that way and then turn it to the practice of Vipassana, where you're discerning anicca, dukkha, and anatta in whatever it is, whatever mental or material phenomena is arising and passing away. And you can have the direct insight and experience of the truth of impermanence, suffering, and non-self. Because everything's impermanent, it's inherently filled with suffering. So anything we hold on to, anything we cling to, what's the word I used? Upadana. Anytime there's upadana, you know there's going to be suffering, you see. And anytime we identify with this phenomena that is impermanent and filled with suffering, we're going to end up, you know, with more suffering, because there's nothing really to identify with. Everything arises and passes away. So the cultivation of the samatha will allow the meditator a very a very focused and laser-like type of attention that will allow the Vipassana to be profound and deep. So you can practice Vipassana on many different levels. You can practice it on the level of, and all of these levels are wholesome, skillful, and good. So I want to really emphasize that. You can practice it on the level of coming to recognize what's arising and passing away. In other words, what shows up on your radar screen and what leaves your radar screen. And you begin to notice those things as they show up and as they pass away. You begin to sometimes notice them before they even show up. You can begin to notice the intention that's bringing something up. You can begin to see the consequences of going with something or identifying with something. So the cultivation of mindfulness in that way, in a continuous way, will bring a kind of momentary concentration that can then be applied to this. And you know, when the Vipassana practice becomes a little bit deeper and you're a little bit more experienced at it, then it unfolds in a different way. And some meditators report actually experiencing things that are sort of beyond the realm of the cognizing mind. You just begin to see things at a sort of subatomic level sometimes. I don't know if that answered your question or not. Yes?
I'm relatively novice at meditating, but and I don't have a question, actually. I have a couple of responses.
Great.
Tonight, what I found myself doing was figuratively putting my arm around my mind and bringing it back to the breath.
Just lovely.
You know, and it's kind. Let me just bring you back.
Yeah, lovely.
And you validated that notion for me.
Just keep it up and you're going to do great.
I think so. The other thing is, even though I'm a novice at meditating, what I do for a livelihood is I'm a psychotherapist.
Uh-huh.
And what I've noticed as I've been practicing the meditation is when I'm sitting with someone, they're not exactly like the object of, like my breath is the object, but very similar, because when I'm doing that with somebody, it enhances their experience of connection and safety and being listened to. But I've noticed that the small amount of practice that I've done has really helped me bring myself back to the object of my attention.
Absolutely.
And with much less criticism.
Absolutely.
And judgment than what I was trained to do.
Yeah. I really want to thank you for that comment and tell you that that what I wanted to say, and I met with a few people before the meditation and talk tonight. What I wanted to say is that our practice on the cushion and our practice of bringing the mind back kindly and our practice of the way that it unfolds on the cushion, it's absolutely pointless and useless if it stays on the cushion or if it's only valid while we're on the cushion. So you have just given us all a perfect example of the way in which we can integrate it into our day-to-day lives. None of us are monks here that I can tell. And you see, bringing that kind of ability to listen and bring your own mind back to the person that you're actually with is, in fact, a form of meditation practice. And you can see it that way. And you can see that this non-judgmental returning to the breath will, in fact, give you the way to do this in your own life more and more. how many of us have found ourselves talking, or have someone talking to us, and we're really busy thinking about what we're going to say next, or will they please hurry up? I've got something to do or something. And yet you're giving off this sort of image that you're listening. And there's a real disconnection. There is an absolute real disconnection. And it's the same way with the breath, with our object. You know, it's in a way like, I'm too busy. I've got too much going on. I can't be with my breath. You see? It's really no different. And so thank you for the comment, because this is useful because it actually applies in our life off the cushion. I won't say our real life. I'll say our life off the cushion. Our real life is on the cushion or going within. So time for one more question, if anybody has one.
So you talked about other ways to investigate when we have things going on. So can you give a few examples?
Sure. What I meant by that was that while we're meditating, or while we're trying to meditate, and a thought assails us, or a series of thoughts assail us, and we may think, oh, well, this one I should think about. This is important. Or this one, I'm just going to engage with this for a while or something. What I was trying to say was that meditation, the time of meditation, is not the time to engage with that. There's a time to apply investigation. If you want to understand something, there's a time to think about it and try to get to a place of understanding. And there's a place for the thinking mind. Absolutely, there's a place for the thinking mind. It's just not on the meditation cushion. It's not during the time that we're trying to meditate. And so one of the things that I mentioned that I found as a skillful means for myself is to sort of, it's kind of like I'm making a promise to myself that, okay, this is interesting, I'll take it up later, but just not now. You know, I'll look at it later. I'll try to understand it later. You see, I'm not going to engage with it right now. So let's take a trauma that somebody might have experienced that just is really pulling them. You know, it's like in meditation, you recognize the trauma. You don't deny it. You don't push it away. But you don't engage it. You're not trying to understand the trauma. You're not trying to understand who's at fault, how this happened, why it happened, or any of that. There's another time that you could do that, but it's not with meditation. It doesn't serve the meditation.
So my question is, when is that other time? Do you journal, or what is the time?
You could journal anytime that you are not meditating. You can apply that at any other time. I'm just saying, try to understand that the meditation is not for that purpose. You see? Now, the meditation will lead to those kinds of insights and understanding. But if you try to get that kind of understanding through meditation, you're probably not going to get to that understanding, and you're not going to get to deep meditation. I'll tell one last story here to finish answering your question. But the first year that I was a monk in Burma, I would go every day for an interview with my teacher. And I was in a really large monastery. And unlike here in the West, where we generally interview one-on-one with a closed door in private with the teacher, we interviewed in groups. We talked one-on-one, but the monks would line up two, two, two in a line, and then there was another American that was there, and this poor man was having such difficulties. And he would go, and every day he would report, oh, I've got all this anger coming up, and oh, I've got this issue with my mother coming up, and I've got, and he would go on and on and on, and day after day. And the teacher just looked at him perplexed. He didn't know what to do. And then finally, this went on for a while, and then finally one day, the young monk interviewed again, and he started off with all of this stuff. And the teacher looked at him and said, I'm so sorry. I don't know anything at all about Western psychology. But if you would like to learn how to meditate, I can help you with that. And it was such a beautiful thing, such an honest thing for him to say, because as soon as he said it, the monk understood, oh, this is about meditation. This isn't about me solving my psychological issues here or looking at my psychological issues. There's another time to do that. And so things then turned around. And so that's really all I'm referring to. During meditation, just keep the instructions simple and trust that you can follow them. And if they don't pan out, forget it and go on to something else. But if you do it, you will see that things will begin to move and shift in your own life. And I said earlier, meditation isn't about, you know, making us happier or giving us more fulfilling lives or having better relationships. It's really about freedom, and I'm being given the signal that it's time to stop. So, thank you so much for your attention, and I hope that you found some of this useful.